Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So, John, you ready to tell me where you've been the last 3 years?
You really don't know?
Well, I know that on the day that Ben here turned the wheel, that you and I were sitting on a log. It was a bright light, it was a loud noise, and then you disappeared.
Well, Richard, you're just about to see where I disappeared, too. And after we're finished with that, I'd like you to take me to see Jacob.
That's not how it works, John.
Is that true, Richard? Is this going to be a problem?
You just got back, John. There's no reason to rush into it.
I am the leader now, right?
Yes, John, that's right.
Good. Then I would like you to take me to Jacob. Can you do that?
Yeah, of course.
Fantastic. Let's keep moving. We're almost to the plane.
What plane?
It's a Beechcraft. It used to smuggle heroin. It flew out of Nigeria, crashed here. All right, Richard, listen very carefully, because you're only going to have about 3 minutes to get this right.
Get what right?
A man's about to walk out of the jungle. He's been shot in the leg. You'll need this to get the bullet out.
I'm sorry, John.
Just listen. This is the important part. You're going to need to tell him that he has to bring everyone who left back to the island. And when he asks how to do that, you tell him he's going to have to die.
Who is that man, John?
It's a beautiful morning. Let's take a nice long swim, dig into some newly found boar, and have a nice chat about the penultimate episode of Lost Season 5. Shall we, folks? Come on, let's do it.
Misdeeds with the dead man's lead. Sawyer and Jackman, they just love to bleed. Trailers come in pay to get on the sub. Time to take a field trip to see Jacob.
Go back down the hatch. It's the Lost Rewatch Podcast. Here, I post a recap stock of season 5, episode 15. Follow the leader. This is Josh Wigler following up on that beautiful Bruce Springsteen. Born in the what did
no,
you say?
It's not born in the USA. It's Bomb and the Radzinske.
Bomb in the Radzinske.
Bomb and the Radzinske. So here's my creative process.
Bomb. This is Mike Bloom. Hi, Mike Bloom.
Hello.
Bomb and the Radzinske.
Yeah, so this is my own creative process.
That is next level stuff, Mike. Very good.
Thank you very much. You know, I'll admit, when it comes to pulling things out of this, like, labyrinthian, depraved mind of mine, I usually just think of, like, well, what will make me laugh? And I'm not going to lie. I was sitting there yesterday. I was driving to pick up my son, thinking of, like, all right, I got to do some sort of Springsteen parody. Josh is on vacation, so I have the duty this time. I'm the leader for this instance. What should I do? And for some reason, I thought of Bomb and the Radzinske. And I kid you not, I was laughing for about 4 straight minutes to myself. And I'm like, okay, I think this is a good, I cleared the first gate, right? Like, if it made me laugh, I'm hoping it makes at least one other person laugh, that person being Josh Wigler. I think this is a mission success. Quote, 2 episodes from now, it worked. So I feel happy personally.
Bomb and the Radzinske.
I
would say it worked. It worked. Unbelievable. Honoring the time-honored tradition of doing a Bruce Springsteen song parody for the penultimate episode of a season of Lost here on Down the Hatch. We are nothing if not very on brand, folks. We are at the penultimate episode of season 5, Mike Bloom. It's Follow the Leader, and it's got nothing to do with the Wario Casino.
Yeah, unfortunately. Actually, I don't know. We know that the Man in Black.
I don't know. Some people are taking chances. There's some chances. People are taking chances.
Yeah, and there's like a bomb about to go off, right? That's the equivalent of like throwing some sort of Mario laden device in there to just blow everything up. So there's a lot of items being thrown around, a lot of gambits being made as we're really setting the stage. I mean, you say this a lot with penultimate episodes, Josh, but this really does feel like the incident part one to the parts 2 and 3, and that it really does seem like its purpose is to put characters in a certain position to open up parts 2 and 3, which I would say, you know, there's no place like home part 1 certainly did, but that at least had like a framing device of, you know, a flashback thing. I think that's what distinguishes this from other penultimate episodes, because we've certainly had, I just mentioned there's no place like home. Exodus was another one that had a part 1, you know, air a week before parts 2 and 3. You've talked about how Greatest Hits can almost be like Through the Looking Glass part 1. I think where those differ is the fact that we still do have that framing device to work through. This is actually a good sequel episode to Because You Left in many ways, but one of them being this is one of those season 5 episodes that has no centric character. And so it does kind of lie in this weird place of being connected to the finale, but not really being connected to the finale. That being said, you know, cards out, I enjoyed this episode more than I thought I would.
Yeah, well, it is very much like Smokey McSmokerton is just like getting the ducks in a row, you know, and like that is highly enjoyable. I think the return of Saeed is something that I really like. I think like we're kind of like in a few of our final like really just great Saeed moments coming up here. I think that there is like this sort of sense of forward momentum. I think that the penultimate episode of Lost typically serves, which I'm now realizing is a great word choice for the metaphor. I think that it's like the penultimate episode is like the first process of the serve in tennis. You're throwing the ball up into the air, and then it's the finale's job to ace the opponent. And I think that does it always work out that way? I don't know. I think like Born to Run in season 1 is setting up the raft launch very well. I think in season 2 you find out what Michael's whole thing is doing, and like why he's doing what he's done.
Jury's still out on what my whole thing is.
Yeah, we're still trying to work on that. Season 3, I think, is the classic example of Greatest Hits really setting up not just like we're going to, like Jack's cards are finally turned over, we're going to blow up the others, and Charlie is finally ready to seize his destiny. Season 4, whether you want to assign that to Cabin Fever or to There's No Place Like Home Part 1, I think it's a very similar deal of we have to move the island is the big Cabin Fever setup. So it sends you into that final episode of like, can they do that? Is that a thing? I think this episode very much accomplishes these things. It's, you know, here's the bomb. We're getting the Jughead. We're setting up, like, we're putting, like, the bomb in the drawer to go off in the final act. And then there's the major bomb of the seemingly, like, congenial John Locke, who has returned with all of the confidence in the world, now saying, I want you to kill the leader of the island. And it is such a dark turn. And obviously it plays very differently for us knowing who this guy actually is. But it is both of these storylines are very deliberately setting off what's going to happen in the finale. These are threats that they are going to make good on one episode later. So I think it's exciting stuff. I've made no bones about the fact that I really do love a lot of like
the chess PC stuff on Lost. Mm-hmm. I love hanging out with the characters. I love seeing them just travel the island and do shit. This is a great travel the island and do shit episode.
That being said, I think there are some character moments that I do not remember, but certainly pop up here that I think, in my opinion, differ from an episode like Namaste, which I was certainly not as high on. Also, I think it's necessary because we'll talk about this with the incident. The incident might be one of the most plot forward finales in comparison to the other ones, where characters will certainly get their moments, but I think that a lot is done more so in service to like the Jacob stuff and everything going on with the titular incident, that I'm glad that this episode exists to give some of these other moments to characters. Like, for instance, Miles's arc kind of closes here in this episode. He's going to have that moment next episode where he does end up kind of saving Pierre Chang's life, but not one of his hands. But for all intents and purposes, like, we are closing the loop on what has existed in the past couple of episodes. I think this episode is sneakily character-driven in a lot of ways. There's a lot of good Sawyer and Juliet stuff, which is heartbreaking knowing this is going to be, you know, we're within hours of their last conversation that they're going to have together on the island. So I think there's a lot of really interesting character stuff, and especially, like you said, it's been a while. We're going back to the John Locke stuff for the first time since Dead is Dead, where we really saw Smokey come into his own, and we saw him there really manipulate, you know, the Ajira people and Ben especially. But now we have this really unique experiment of, back in the day, John Locke was given the keys to the castle and was there for all of like 10 seconds. What happens when someone pretending to be John Locke finally gets to be in control of the others? And it's a really fun thing to watch, especially considering from the Man in Black aspect, and especially the Man in Black Richard Alpert duo that we're going to find out much more later on in Abaterno have a really storied history together. To watch these two, I wouldn't say watch these two jockey for power, because Richard Alpert does a lot of abdication in this episode, but to watch their dynamic.
Abdication Turno.
There we go. I think we got there. I think we got there.
No, we did. I don't know that we did.
I personally approve it. It's a, you know, recompense for you approving of Bomb and the Reds and Stay so much. But I think that it's an interesting setup of what's to come in a lot of ways from the 2007 side of things. And even though I would say the 2007 side of things is by far the weaker of the duo between this and 1977, there's some strong stuff in here, especially that wallop of a final scene that we'll get to.
All right. Before we get into it, let's take a quick moment to thank our sponsors for this episode of Post Show Recaps. Those are our friends over at Geico. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. And I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com. With all of that said, let us go forth into the jungle and talk about Follow the Leader, which is technically a Richard Alpert-centric. I think that is, like, officially the credit. Because he's really, he's sort of, like, in the way of, like, even though Namaste gets credited to Frank, like, you're really kind of, like, threading through the quans, like the quantum entanglement, quite literally, of, like, Jin and Sun in different time periods. This is a tale of two Richards. It's the same guy, but because of his, you know, veritable agelessness, he's able to experience, you know, we're able to experience him in two very separate points in time as played by the same actor, mercifully without any need for ridiculous flashback hair. Although I wouldn't have minded, like, I don't know, should they have, like, tried to give Richard Alpert a mushroom cut at one point in time? Are we missing out on, like, a deep 90s Richard Alpert? Like, should he have gone full mushroom at one point?
Or at least 70s, you know? Like, when do the trends from the outside world make their way over? We'll see, obviously, when he's Ricardus, he has the long-haired look to him. Obviously, he chopped all that up. But it's a good point. Did he try dye at one point? You know, did he try to go for some of that sandy brown to mimic Jacob's hair?
Well, he does have, like, the long hair when Ben meets him for the first time. But is that a wig? Is he, like, trying his old look again? I don't know. But either way, it's a tale of two Richards.
Ooh, do you think Richard ever tried dreads?
No. Probably not. I don't know. I don't know why he would. Maybe. I guess like he's been alive for a long time. It's possible, Mike, that there's not a lot that he hasn't done.
That's very true. Go through like the men's hairstyle book that you see at a local haircutting place. Richard Halper's
very worldly.
Done them all.
Yeah. He's a very worldly guy.
But yeah, so the reason why people usually say Richard is because, much like we've seen in the past, when we do our usual flashback drums, it's usually between Richard scenes, right? Like there's that one moment where Eloise quotes her future self and says, all right, let's get started. And the camera focuses on Richard. Drums take us into that scene that we heard in the intro of him walking through the jungle with Locke and Ben. So a lot of like the direct transitioning between scenes happens with Richard Alpert, even though Richard Alpert himself is more of a conduit in this episode. He's a tunnel, not the bomb.
Should we have called this episode The Conduit?
That would have been interesting. How about The Con to Wit?
The Con to Wit. Yeah. Is it the con like to it, as in like the con like you're going over to it? Or is it like The Con to Wit?
Exactly. Like, the con, yeah. Comma, to wit.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. I think that's great. Probably not.
I think people will feel like they're feeling like, what the hell is, what the hell are they doing?
Do we like follow the leader?
Cute. I think it's cute. I think it's
cute,
obviously.
Not hot.
Well, actually, I think it's actually very appropriate because there's a lot. One of the main themes of this episode, again, one why I like it is because I think it's more thematically representative than just moving the pieces along. There's a lot of leadership exchanges happening here where you have, obviously, the main stories, I think, Richard yielding leadership to Locke. But you have, you know, Ben, who's the former leader of the others, now living with the others under Locke for the first time. Even the small things like Winmore abdicating to Eloise's plan, Sawyer sort of like metaphorically and leaving the island, letting Jack take over as the leader of this bomb mission. And hell, Rudzinski himself gets in on the theming, right? He supplants Horace as the leader of the Dharma security team and assumingly the entire DI at this point. So I think it actually is a very thematic title.
Yeah, I think it works. And also, like, I just keep getting following the leader.
Yes, from Peter Pan. I had the exact same thought.
Yeah, yeah, I get that stuck in my head. And then the other thing that I get stuck in my head, which maybe I would have done if I had been in charge of the song parody, even though it's not Bruce Springsteen, would have been, follow the leader. I just couldn't get Cry Me a River out of my head with follow
the leader. Oh, gotcha. I was like, I was trying to put the melody to it.
It's a little bit of Timberlake is kind of where
I was at. Listen, they're doing a lot of swimming in the pond, so I think that like making it water-related would not be too out of the realm of possibilities.
Are you saying that because of a river or because of Timberlake?
Oh, I like that. You've got to swim under the Timber Lake.
We're lost. We're lost. We're lost. Recalibrating. All right. Jack and Kate, we get like sort of like their perspective on what happens after Daniel enters the camp. And they're like talking about how like, is this crazy or is this why we're here? We have a differing of opinions. maybe this is why we're here. This is our one chance to put things back. Before this conversation can develop much further, it certainly will later on. Daniel Faraday gets shot and killed by his mom?
Yeah, I like this because this is, you know, Kate's going to tell Jack later that he's really showing Locke in all of the warts and all. But I think in this moment, it's very much Jack being like, no, I really believe him. Cut to him being shot. And this idea of, okay, maybe this plan isn't going to work, which was our sense at the end of The Variable, right? That Daniel Faraday was wrong at the end of all of this. And it's a really interesting perspective to watch Jack in these last two episodes, knowing that he is going to be wrong, that his attempts to try to change the future will be for naught, and it will end up to the deaths and certainly maiming of certain people. But to see the reasoning behind Jack with it, you know, there certainly are reasons why you could give, I think, both he and Kate LVP points in this episode. I think they're more well-deserved for certain characters, which we'll get into. But it's intriguing to see, as we sort of doted upon last episode, but really get vocalized here, Jack has finally found his purpose. He's been, you know, lying in wait with his hunting rifle ready to shoot something that finally came into his path, that big buck to bring down. And he finally sees it in his scope. And he's like, okay, perfect. This is what I want to do. No matter how much I may be misled, no matter how much Daniel Faraday might have gotten shot by his own mother, I still think this is the right thing to do.
Yeah. This goes poorly. Daniel is killed. Kate and Jack are, I don't know why I was just about to say, Kate and Jack are arrested. The others are arresting Kate.
Is it like vigilantism, you know?
I don't know. Like, you're under arrest. I don't think that's something that the others are saying.
To quote Sawyer, they have no authority here.
Yeah, you guys are under arrest. So they arrest Jack and Kate. Back at the camp, Eloise is flipping through the journal. She's like, oh, shit. Because she's recognizing her own handwriting in the message to Daniel. She's like, okay, so I'm pretty sure I just killed my time-traveling son, but I'm going to need, like, a few conversations with a couple of people to, like, really be sure about that, but this doesn't feel great.
So, speaking of her time-traveling son, I'm trying to remember the face that Daniel Faraday died with. Because I'm not going to lie, the way Jeremy Davies looks in this episode and those close-ups is a skosh doofy, in my opinion, of just, like, the look on his face. I think he was more horrified when he died at the end. Maybe his face just naturally relaxed into more of a doofy face.
Yeah, I don't know, but I think it's lovely. So Richard is like, this guy just came in. He put a gun up to me, and Charles is like, what's going on here? Why do we have all these people here? They're not from the, and Ellie's like, they're not from the Dharma Initiative, these guys.
I guess Dharma declared war. Screw the truce, as weird as it may have been. And Ellie was like, no. They're not from it. Don't worry about it. I've got it. Go back on your little horsey and go ride out into the jungle, Charles.
I love middle-aged Charles Widmore. He looks great.
Yeah, the war turtle Charles Widmore makes a return here.
Yeah, he's great. So we get that, like, well, if they're not from the Dharma Initiative, then where are they from? Smash, 30 years later. And when we come back in, it's 2007. A little Richard Alpert with a little ship. Well, isn't this so cute? Some foreshadowing. A little ship in a bottle.
I don't know. It's interesting. Guy. Has he gotten over the trauma to that point that he's building one? You know, you feel like it hit a little too close to home, right? Like if someone from 815 was building a model plane in a bottle.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know if, like, you know, if, like, the thing that traumatized you becomes your hobby at some point. But Richard Alpert's been alive for a long time, so I don't know. Even revisiting that comment,
Either an argument for or against immortality, that the things that haunt you, you'll eventually make hobbies out of.
Yeah, okay. So let's listen in. Let's use this as sound number one, because Richard Alpert is going to, he's going to see a ghost, isn't he?
A ghost.
Richard, he's here.
I brought dinner.
John?
Hello, Richard. It's been a while.
It's been 3 years. What happened? Where were you?
I'll explain on the way.
On the way? Where?
It's going to be night soon. You and I have an errand to run, and we don't have a lot of time. What's wrong?
Something different about you.
I have a purpose now.
What's he doing here?
He helped me get back.
Why did Locke say these were his people? I thought they were yours.
When I left the island, John stepped in. He's the leader now.
Who's that man he's talking to?
His name is Richard Alpert. He's a kind of advisor. And he has had that job for a very, very long time. Son, what are you...
Were you here in 1977?
Excuse me?
These people. Jack Shepherd, Kate Austin, Hugo Reyes. They were here with my husband, Jin Won. Were you here? Do you remember them? Any of them?
Yes, I was here.
30 years ago. And I do, I remember these people. I remember meeting them very clearly because I watched them all die.
So, a couple things about this. First, there is a deleted scene for this episode that I guess at one point in time was actually going to open the episode instead of the Jack and Kate Rashomon stuff that shows Ben, Sun, and Locke hunting said boar.
Oh, that's fun.
We're basically, I'll talk through just like a couple of pieces of dialogue here.
Yeah.
Sun says, where is he taking us? Ben says, wherever he wants. And Sun says, do you know how he plans to get us back to our people? Ben, our people are in 1977, Sun. So the operative question would be, how does he plan to get them back to us? Locke turns around. John? Locke points a gun at Ben and runs past him, shooting a boar. Locke says, sorry if the noise hurts your ears. He picks up the boar on his shoulders. Locke says, hate to let this go to waste. They might be hungry. Sun says, who might be hungry? Locke says, my people. And he walks away while Ben stares in surprise, which actually is a fun mirroring to how the episode ends, right? With, like, Locke dropping this big bomb, pun unintended, and leaving Ben just, like, standing there, shocked. So, not shot. So, yeah, now we find out through this deleted scene how he ended up getting the boar. It's a fun mirror as well to how the season began. If you remember in The Lie, Miles walks into camp with a boar. In that case, you know, the connection between the two characters is interesting. Miles got the boar because he could talk with dead animals, knew the animal was dead. You know, Man in Black killed the boar, but this is also a creature slash human embodiment of something that has the ability to talk with the dead or, you know, mimic the dead in a way. So it's an interesting thematic connection between these two characters on top of a delicious choice from MIB to be like, what would John Locke do in this moment?
Well,
he'd probably walk in with a boar over his head.
Well, it's also a great homage to Walkabout. And Locke returning to camp with the boar that we presume is effectively gifted to him by the monster all the way back then. So this is at least the monster's like second pig that we can account for, if not more than that along the way. So I think it's great. I think it's like it's a very Lockean moment, but it is also very consistent with the monster's connection to John Locke. It's like one of their, like, their old, you know, it really is sort of like their first sacred meeting.
Their first date.
You know, so it's great. But I love Richard being like, something's changed about you. Like, something's different. And John Locke may as well just be like, yeah, well, I'm a totally different guy.
Yeah, I'm not a simpering little pimpy anymore, Richard.
Oh my god.
I feel like he would talk like that, would he not?
Oh my goodness. We're getting the bleeps out again.
But yeah, I mean, that very much, though, I think is very evocative of like the John Locke was a sucker line we're going to get, right? Of essentially, this is the Man in Black making a crack about John Locke in John Locke's body. That to your point, they had a relationship, but the Man in Black always saw himself above John Locke. So he's like, yeah, I'm better than this guy. I actually know what I'm doing at this point. And there's also some very loaded dialogue in It's Been a While. I mean, could you imagine that this is the real first interaction the Man in Black has had with Richard Alpert since Abaterno?
That's so hard to believe. I think it's possible that it's the first one that they've had where Richard. No, I mean, like this wouldn't quite work. I was gonna say the first one where Richard is aware of who the guy is. Like I have to imagine he has encountered the Man in Black on other occasions, potentially not knowing that it's the Man in Black. Right. Like, I think like that makes sense because the smoke monster has appeared in so many other different forms. I think we gotta like there has to be a reason why the smoke monster hasn't killed Richard yet. He's going to say in the final season, like, want you to join me. I want the same thing I've always wanted with you, Richard. So I think like the monster for sure has at least kept tabs on Richard. Why they wouldn't have interacted at some point over the course of all this time feels kind of weird to me. I have to imagine that they've interacted. Do you feel differently?
I don't know. Maybe it's more so that they've interacted. I'm certain that Richard Alpert has had some sort of interaction with the smoke monster. But that to me feels distinctly different than the conversation they have in Abaterno, right? Where Man in Black's like, I'm going to get to you before Jacob gets to you and bring you over to my side. Maybe that's what he's alluding to. Because, like, we talked about this in Dead is Dead, right? Lots of loaded dialogue where he's like, I know something you don't know. I very much get this sense here. To your point, it could either be a reference to the only other interaction we've seen between the two, or maybe it's been a while, as in, like, it's been 10 years, and they've had correspondences or moments in the hundreds of years since Richard arrived on the island, but it has indeed been a while.
One other thing that I really enjoy in this scene is when, like, Sun comes up to Richard and, like, do you know any of these people? And Richard says, I was there 30 years ago and I remembered watching them all die. Obviously very provocative going into the final episodes of the season.
Such a cliffhanger.
Like, oh shit, okay, this is gonna go poorly. Or is it? Like, what else could he have possibly seen? Like, I think those are, like, things that are rushing through your head in that moment. But the other thing is that, like, this, like, really colors the way Richard Alpert has been operating on this island, and potentially how, like, depending on who he's disclosed this to, like, when Oceanic 815 dropped, did Richard just, like, keep all of this to himself? Like, you know, the others have extensive files on at least Jack Shepard, and we certainly presume the rest of them. They know enough about Kate to tell John Locke she's a fugitive and, like, give her, like, the full rundown of what she's done beyond just when she was outed as a fugitive by Sawyer. Like, just when they told me what you did, you know, like, he knows, like, stuff from the others. Did Richard just, like, he had to have known that some of these people were like, oh God, that's one of those guys that I saw in the 1970s. Okay. Yeah. Things are, like, activating. Things are happening. Like, we're getting into place. Does he just sit on this? Does he just not want to interfere at all? And, like, see, like, are there some sort of, like, should we, like, see if, like, we have a little more agency involved in, like, sending these people back? Like, this is interesting to me in a way that, like, potentially is, like, compelling for the right reasons, and then there are other ways where it's like, is this a little bit of a lapse? Like, wouldn't Richard have, like, I don't know, wanted to intercede maybe a little bit more? Is it just, like, he's such a strict Jacob loyalist that the rule of the land is don't interfere? Maybe it's that.
Yeah, I mean, could Richard Alpert be? I know that we've got What If on the brain. Could he sort of feel like he has a bit of an Uatu role here? Right, of like, I watch, I know, but I cannot interfere from that perspective, especially if when John Locke comes waltzing in 1954 and says, I'm from the future, and basically busts his head open about time travel. We talked about this with Eloise last week about how much is this idea of whatever happened, like, burned into his brain to the point of inaction. I'm not entirely sure. To your point, I'm going to proposition now a second Lost Radio play to be made. That's just like the Richard Alpert episode, not Abaterno, but basically seeing everything from 1977 on through his eyes. My headcanon is that he knows this information. He probably tells Jacob at some point. But I think because leadership in the others otherwise changes hands so quickly, the two of them would keep that secret between the two of them because it is such, like, a monumental thing that it's like we don't necessarily trust all these guys between your Charles Widmore's, your Eloise Hawkins, your Benjamin Linus's, whoever, that, you know, they definitely won't be around as long as we are, Richard. I don't think we necessarily need to bring everyone in on the big secret. This is just a need-to-know basis. That's the way I think about it. And I know that some people, you know, might have reservations for Richard because it's like, well, they didn't die, so, you know, why did you mislead them into thinking that they did? But actually, apparently, there was, there's like a, on the season 5 Blu-ray, there's an outline of the season finale on an image of a whiteboard in the writer's room. And apparently, there was a different final scene where, you know, Juliet hits Jughead in frustration, the screen cuts to white, and Richard Alpert sees Jughead explode in the distance.
Yeah.
So it's very much like that idea of, you know, the way Sawyer was operating in the beginning of season 5, the way everyone in the Oceanic 6 were operating when they thought Jin was dead, of like, something blew up, the bodies aren't there, I have a feeling they're dead.
Right. I think all of that tracks. So I love this next scene when we come back from commercial of John Loki, the Smoke Man himself, talking to Sun, and this whole conversation about, like, listen, we didn't go through all of this for nothing. He basically is like, if there's a way for you and Jin to be together again and a way to save our people, I'll find it. This shit's a lie, man. Like, this dude is... I love John Loki. I really... Season 5 John Loki is exceptional.
We're back in 2012 all over again, right? Like, yes, lie to me, daddy. I love this. Keep tricking these rubes.
He is very much all about just, like, whatever to get... Like, I'm so close to the finish line. I will do and say anything at this point. Not that he wasn't before, but there's also sort of like, there's like an ease to which he's doing all of this and like a giddiness. And you know, I've talked about this before in terms of like my feeling on the monster, that like some of the traits of the people he takes on just like glom on and he feels them earnestly. And John Locke loves nothing more in the world than being on this island. So there's like gotta be like a sense to which like he's just smelling the air. He's got the sand between his toes. Like he's just like feeling the breeze and he's about to kill his ancient adversary. And there is just such a readiness about the smoke monster in all this. And I think it's like really present in the way that he lies to Sun. I think is really, really, really well done.
Well, I think also let's remember that this is a character who is used to manipulation, right? He is used to probing the minds of his torture victims and appearing in the visage of something that you think might drive them over the edge, in the case literally with Jack in White Rabbit. So he's pretty good at reading people from that perspective. And so I think he is totally fine with lying through his teeth to Sana, being like, yeah, you want to get back together with Jin? So do I. That's totally fine. He has no problems doing that, as opposed to the real John Locke certainly had his deceptions beforehand. But again, I think it was still based in like this overall sense of purpose. Man in Black certainly does, but I think he has a much easier time of just completely fibbing to somebody and saying that I'm on the same side as you when he's not whatsoever.
Right.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So Locke is fake. Locke is going to ask Richard, do you still have the compass I gave you? And so this is where we're going to get into like Schrodinger's compass, right? Like we're going to get into like, how did the compass come to be? It's a total paradox. And like, how does the smoke monster know to go to this moment? I think one of the things that we accept about the smoke monster's abilities, based on what he says in the season 6 premiere, when he's able to tell Ben like what John Locke was thinking before he died, that like he knows specifically the circumstances in which he died. So like you get the sense that he has memories. Like you do get the sense that he has like attributes of John Locke, of the people that he takes on, that he learns this stuff. So I feel like in doing that, if he's taking on the experiences of John Locke, Mike, and whatever happened as a rule, that means that what is about to happen in terms of giving the compass to John Locke from Richard Alpert has already happened to John Locke. So the smoke monster would have access to those memories. He would also have access to the memories of the compass going to Richard. Ergo, makes sense, according to the smoke monster in this moment in time, like, well, we got to go give the compass to John Locke and tell him he's got to go die. I think that all tracks for me. I don't know if I'm explaining it well, but like I can certainly see the line as for how the monster knows to go into the woods and get Richard to give John Locke the compass in this upcoming moment.
Right. I think people remind us, whoever's listened to and remembers our recap of Because You Left, because this is where this scene comes up. I think you mentioned that. I think you also mentioned the fact that there's also a chance the smoke monster was, like, hanging around during that time too, maybe. Oh, no, actually, that would happen in the future, so that doesn't make any sense. Yeah, I could see that. I could see the fact that in implanting himself, we've talked about this before, that I think it's within the realm of possibility for the smoke monster to be able to, like, scan the memories of a person, especially if they are, you know, trying to embody them. We talked about this with, like, playing the part of Yemi, playing the part of the black horse for Kate. So I think that it's within the realm of possibilities, certainly. Otherwise, yeah, it's this odd thing of, okay, but where did the compass ever come from is a very, it's a little bit of a breaky question, but I think it's a fun question. You know, it's not something that's going to completely have me throw the entire plot out the window. It's more of a meta example of just how twisty and sometimes nonsensical the idea of whatever happened. And the time travel aspects of season 5 is, I see it more as like a glitchy celebration than saying like, oh, throw this video game out, it's all buggy.
Yeah, I think it's fine. I have no issue with it. I think it tracks for me. I get it if it doesn't for other people. But I think based on the rules of time travel as established by the show, I think that it makes sense. And the rules of the smoke monster up to this point, as like at least heavily suggested, if not outright established by the show, then I think it also tracks. I love smoke monster telling Ben to come with us, like he's not leaving him behind, and Ben being like, why are you afraid? I'll stage a coup. And the smoke monster says, I'm not afraid of anything you can do. Very, yeah, so dismissive.
So dismissive. Well, especially I think post Dead is Dead. Right. Like, essentially, this is Ben and Richard Alpert just being like massively emasculated over the course of an episode. Right. Like, Ben receives some salvation at the end of this. He felt like he was saved, spared by the island. But now I think he's starting to come into the reality of like, yeah, you have no power anymore. John Locke knows the island. He has your people. He feels he can directly communicate with Jacob, which you cannot. Like, who are you right now? And that's going to directly lead into the big thing that Benjamin Linus does in the season 5 finale.
Yeah.
But I think right now, Locke is certainly digging in on that feeling, right? Of like, yeah, you used to be the big bad. In fact, you were the main villain of season 3, but who are you anymore? We don't even care about that.
Who are you really? Okay, so the monster tells Sun, I'll figure this out. Like, I'll get you and Jin back together, ideally on a submarine with a time bomb. Yeah, if there's a way to save our people, I'll find it. Yeah, for him, like, saving our people is freeing them of the island, which may be interpreted as freeing them of existence.
yeah, we're going to untie these mortal coils fettered.
I'm going to save your lives by destroying them.
Saeed-like perspective, right, as we'll get to later?
I never lied. In 1977, Jack is getting beaten up. He's getting interrogated. When that's over, a badly beaten Jack Shepard and Kate Austin are going to have a conversation where they are revisiting what they were talking about before they got arrested by the others. Let's listen in sound two.
Are you okay?
Yeah.
You know, before we were caught, you said that we needed to put things back the way they were supposed to be. What did you mean by that?
If we can do what Faraday said, our plane never crashes. Flight 815 lands in Los Angeles, and everyone we lost since we got here, they'd all be alive.
And what about us? We just go on living our life because we've never met.
All the misery that we've been through, we just wipe it clean. Never happened.
It was not all misery.
Enough of it was.
Is it weird to say I can see both sides here?
I can see it from Kate's side being like, yo, don't do that. I'm going to jail. Like, no, let's
and
not
also,
change
and
that.
And also, like, Aaron, I really love Aaron. Like,
I love
this was,
Aaron,
that was great.
But also, like, I don't want to go to jail. No, if we do, if this works, I go to prison, Jack. He's like, oh. You know, if she just says that, maybe it's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, maybe that's a good point. Like, he's not thinking
Again,
from Kate's perspective.
He's still a little frustrated about her, though, right? Like, when he tells her a couple episodes ago, like, you never liked the old me. I think he clearly is still holding some resentment about everything from Something Nice Back Home and 316. I mean, I think what this really comes down to is the distinct disconnect in these two characters based on where they are in their lives. We spoke about this before. Jack is completely empty of fulfillment in this moment for so many ways. He thought he could have succeeded in his goal of getting off the island. Turns out he made a mistake. We have to go back. Now that he's back here, he's still trying to figure out, like, what the hell am I supposed to do? I feel aimless from that regard. Now, Kate has not completely succeeded in her goal. She has yet to find Claire and have her leave the island to bring her back to Aaron. But she certainly has found more purpose, right? Much like John Loki. I think she certainly feels more grounded, more guided. And so I do think I can understand both of their perspectives here, right? Where Kate says, yeah, I've experienced a butt ton of heartbreak, but like, I'm in a pretty good place right now. I found peace. I realize you have to take the good with the bad. And here's Jack, who's like, it's been mostly bad for me. There have been very little moments of good. Also, people have died. It'd be nice if they weren't dead anymore. Not everyone was like Charlie and had a nice old happy hunky-dory death. A lot of people died very tragically,
yeah,
and very darkly. It'd be nice to undo that. So I think I could understand their POVs based on not only like their own perspectives on everything, but also where they feel like they are in their own character arcs. We spoke about this, that like the Kate arc has not necessarily reached a conclusion, but I think found a natural settling point, whereas Jack is far from that right now.
Correct. I think that that's right. And I think that for Jack, like, when he says, like, enough of it was bad, like, he, like, I can see the line for him where, like, things have been so awful in his world, a lot of it of his own making, a lot of mistakes that he's made, that maybe he can fix it, right? Like, let me fix this. I'll fix it so it never happened. Like, this is the thing. Like, this is why I'm here. I'm here to make it so that I get to wipe the slate clean, tabula rasa. I don't have to worry about any of this anymore because it's never going to happen. That's why I'm here. Rather than figuring out that, like, whatever happened, happened. And it's like what you do next that matters. You can't change the past. You can't change stuff. You have to accept what happened and you have to move forward. You know, whether that's for redemption or redemption is just freaking off the table and it's just because it's what's right. Like, it's never too late to do the right thing. You know, like, reward be damned. And he is, I don't think he's all the way there. You know, we still have a whole other season of the show that we have to get through. But I think it's a really interesting place to leave him where, like, he's trying to do the John Locke thing of looking for signs and believing in the island, believing in the island's wisdom and, like, trusting the island's process. And that this is, like, a thing that he has to do. And it's a very similar thing as what's going on with John Locke during, like, a lot of that stuff for him, where often... No, he is, like, fulfilling destiny, and he is doing the things that need to happen because they always happened, that these are all things that are part of, you know, the wheel of destiny, so to speak. Mm. And, like, it's often unsatisfying, and it's often frustrating, and it sometimes leads to people getting killed, and it's often a mistake, but just because it's a mistake doesn't mean it's not what's supposed to go down. And I think that that is, like, where Jack is about to be, and he's about to get, like, I think with, like, the nuclear bomb and this whole mission being a bit of a failure, like, this is, and it's not lost on me, Mike, that this all has to do with the same general location. It's about the hatch. Mm. It's about the Swan Station. That this mission for Jack Shepard is what it was for John Locke when he was desperately trying to get into the hatch, to find out what's beneath the door. What happens when I go down there? What's waiting for us? It's going to change our destiny forever. And for Jack, it's about... I know what's beyond this door. Like, I know what's beyond this door that has yet to be built. I know what's down there, and I know how to stop it, and this is what's going to happen, and you have to trust me, this is what's going to work. And John Locke isn't wrong, and Jack isn't wrong either, that what he's about to do is vitally important because it's a part of, like, unbreakable history. It's just that they're both going to be at least immediately disappointed with the results.
Yeah, I really love that comparison, not only to entering the hatch, but also being down in the hatch, too, right? The whole thing of live together, die alone is Locke saying, in a way, like, let's break the wheel. You know, we're just rats running around looking for some cheese.
Right.
We're just, you know, we can change our fate. We can do this. It doesn't matter. That is sort of, I think, the perspective that Jack is going to take as well here of there's a way we usually go about things, but we're not going to do that. We are going to defy our fates and we're going to show we have free will and we are going to move forward on a completely new path. It's not a coincidence that they are both wrong, too. And I think it's a really fun comparison. And I also really like the idea that despite Jack Shepard imbuing himself with more of Locke's things, he still has to fix stuff.
Yeah.
Right? At the end of the day, if he's been given this offer of, well, you can fix everything, he's like, fix? Great! Call me Fix-a-Felix. I'm going to do that. You know, he still gets caught up in this idea of, despite trying to learn to let things go and not having to stubbornly rely on making sure everything and everyone is okay, when an offer gets thrown in front of him, you know, if he gave up sugar for Lent, and then they said, you just want a trip to Charlie's Chocolate Factory, he's like, oh, all right, let me see those Oompa Loompas. I'll do it. I don't want to, but I'll do it.
Yeah. I love it. I think it's great. But I also do get, like, Kate's perspective. Like, no, don't do this. This is stupid. It wasn't all terrible.
It's a little bit of like a not a glass half full, half empty, because again, these two have not experienced the same things. We talked about this, but Kate, relatively speaking, had like a pretty damn good 3 years off the island outside of the paranoia coming from Dan Norton and everybody else.
If not good, then at least like you know, one that had purpose to it, right? Like one that like felt like it made sense. Like one that was like she did things that she had to do. And she found love and she found connection. And the reason she's back here is to help that boy, to like save that boy, to find his mother, to bring her back. And this whole mission is like very contrary to that. Like he's eventually going to like kind of like sell her on the logic of Claire's not here. You're not going to find her here. The thing you're looking for isn't happening here. My way will bring Claire back. It'll change everything, but she'll get to Los Angeles. She'll get to like make the choices that she wants to make. She'll get to do what she feels is right for Aaron. And I think like if I have a big critique of the incident, and maybe it'll change when we start talking it through, it's like I do think like some of the people are just like really easy sells on this mission when like I don't know that that's necessarily how they would play it. But like I understand at least right now why Kate is like really definitely not feeling it.
I do think we'll talk about this next week, that I wonder if this is an idea that if they somehow have 20 episodes instead of 16 and they spend more time trying to get people on board with the idea, does that help? You know,
right.
if we spend episodes of people undergoing things and getting hooked on this idea. I mean, that would definitely change the time frame, right? Because obviously the incident is not, unless they do a final season of How I Met Your Mother and every episode takes place over like an hour in real time, maybe like 24. Maybe that's a way to do it outside of, I could understand why in the incident they're like, we kind of have to fast track this. So let's just have like a little bit of a cogent argument happen. And then a character immediately hops on board, even if it's not the most logical thing for them to do.
Right. Okay. So Eloise Hawkins is going to come in and she's like, hey, so did I just kill my son? And Jack's like, yeah, you absolutely did.
That's fun because Jack gets to now become Mr. Time Travel, right?
Yeah.
Like he has, we talked about how last week Daniel Faraday died, but his ideas lived on, especially in someone like Jack. And we see that literally here as Jack has to be the one to walk Eloise Hawking through. Okay, here's what happened. We're from the future indeed, and we need to go do this with your help.
Right. So I love what she's like, does he know what he's talking about? When she looks at Kate, and Kate's like, yeah, he thinks he does. And Fro is like, good enough for me. She's on board with, all right, let's go find the bomb. here's a problem. It's underground and it's beneath the Dharma Initiative. Maybe you guys could help us out. And they're like, oh no, this is not
good. So when the DI start building their village post Jughead, are the others just like, oh, but don't, it's okay. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Yeah, I think maybe they just don't know. I don't know. They don't know that they're building on top of a bomb.
Well, yeah, the DI don't, but I would imagine that, you know, the others, Eloise and Charles Winmore, are like, maybe you shouldn't do that.
Maybe don't do
I'm
it.
I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah, it's probably fine. So that's going on. Meanwhile, we go from the bomb to Radzinske, as Stu is working over Sawyer in front of Juliet. And yeah, he's asserting his dominance. He's in charge. You don't have the stomach for what happens next, Horace.
Yeah, and I guess we're obviously not doing a Sawyer beatdown, though I think it's safe to say he probably gets the second most amount of beatdowns in the series next to Ben. Is this the worst, you think, or do you think being shot by the others at the end of season one is worse?
I don't know. I think that this is up there, like, as far as, like, the worst lickings Sawyer has taken. I think him getting his ass kicked by Pickett was probably pretty bad.
Yeah, Pickett, actually, you're right, might be the worst, because he was also, like, nearly going to die. Here, he's very much bloodied up, but it's more so, like, show wounds, you know, of, like, he's still Kojin, he's still talking, and by that I mean not talking, not saying anything, so... Yeah, definitely not as bad as Pickett, where he seemed like he was literally on his last ounce of life.
So it's gonna take a turn. The beatdown with Sawyer. Why don't we listen in on everything that's going down here? Sound number three.
Hey,
you ready to talk now? Believe me, I'm getting tired of this too, Jim. So why don't you tell me where your girlfriend took the boy? She bring him to the hostels? You know where they are?
Stop! Please!
You want me to stop? Then tell me what I want to know!
Stuart, please. We have known each other for 3 years. We are not bad people. We are not here to hurt you.
Julia, don't. Whatever you tell them, they ain't gonna believe you. So we're gonna get more people hurt.
What are we doing, man? Beating him is pointless, okay? He's not gonna talk.
I can make him talk.
Easy. Easy. Dead man. I'm gonna kill you.
Mr. Rosensky, there's still no sign of Miles or Jen. But the recruits from last week, I got their subs manifest from Amy. They were three last-minute add-ons. They were the two people that shot at you, Shepard and Austin, and one guy we can't track down. He's got to be a part of this.
Who the hell is Hugo Reyes?
He's the fat guy.
Ladies and gentlemen, presenting Paul the Gunman.
Yeah, oh my God, it's me. I'm Saul's cousin, Paul. I work Dharma Security here. I think, Saul, do I have the better job or does Saul have the better job? I don't know. You decide the drill, but
yeah, I'm just saying, a lot more kooky stuff's happening above ground and underground nowadays. You know, I feel like I'm bleeding from the nose.
When I watched this time, I was like, yo, that's Saul's cousin for sure.
Yeah, because here this guy comes with like this thick Brooklyn accent.
He just shows
like, Mr. Radzinski, we got the manifest here.
Mr. Radzinske. Yeah, like, he just, like, shows up. This is actor Kevin Chapman, who is probably best known to TV fans of prestige, like, sort of network drama types like Lost, as Lionel Fusco on Person of Interest.
Was Michael Emerson like, I like that man, put him on my next show?
Maybe, it's possible, but I know that it's still not a show that I've done, and maybe someday, but I know people adore Person of Interest, and so he had an important role on that show. So this guy is not nobody, but it is hilarious. He's Mitch Security is his official name, which is absolutely incredible.
No, because
Saul.
It's absolutely Paul the Gunman. He much like the Human Fibers, disguised his name so that like no one would suspect that they were related.
Actually, Mitch is my last name. I'm Paul Mitch, Paul the Gunman. It's me. That's just me going around.
Well, you remember the manifest that came up in Namaste? Well, I got my hands on it again. Amy Goodspeed, she's not around anymore. She flew an airplane away from the island because she's definitely Amelia Earhart.
But absolute magic.
Here's the manifest. Let's talk about Horace here for a second. Because, I guess Radzinski is right. Horace does not have the cojones. He doesn't have what it takes. And that Horace, like, basically gets shouted down and just sits there and does nothing in response.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I guess it shows that maybe in this moment you have people like Phil and Paul the Gunman who are more loyal to Radzinski. Because otherwise you would imagine that, like, he has them take Radzinski and put him in a holding cell, right? For just completely acting out of line.
Yeah. He's like, I don't know. I hate Phil here, Mike, is my problem. My hang-up.
Oh, well, of course. Yeah, Phil again, he's a weasel.
My hang-up here in this entire scene, because I expect Radzinski to be terrible. I expect Horace to be just like a total bummer. But here comes Phil, this total nerd in the corner, being like, I can make him talk. And he just starts beating the crap out of Juliet. I hate him. I hate him. I hate him so much. I really do. I think that, like, so much of our energy is focused on Stu Radzinski and being awful, and it should be focused on that, but we gotta split it a little bit, because Phil, oh, I hate him. I hate him so much.
Yeah. I mean, listen, Phil's gonna have his own undoing next episode, right? And I guess your mileage may vary as to whether he should get that pull through his chest, but... Yeah, right here, we're sort of like, no, nobody hits our Juliet. What do you think you're doing, Phil? I mean, from a tactical perspective, he might be right. And like, hey, if Sawyer's not talking, if we hit him, if we hit someone who's close to him, maybe that would help. But it does not make him that much better of a person.
No, not at all. So they, Mitch Security, Paul the Gunman, shows up talking about Hurley. And so we cut to Hurley. He's like packing a bunch of stuff. He's got this guitar case, you know, which we still don't know what's in there. And as he's sneaking off, Pierre Chang is following close behind. Remember, we left Dr. Chang with hearing from Daniel Faraday that he is Miles's father. So he tracks Hurley to Jin and Miles and starts to grill them about Pierre the Grillman. About, like, are you guys actually from the future or not? And he starts like asking Hurley all these questions. Hurley says, I'm 46. He's like, so you fought in the Korean War? And Hurley going, there's no such thing.
This is a really great performance from Jorge Garcia. Again, though, his time in season 5 is very limited, especially in the incident. Like, he makes a meal out of what he's been given. And I love this too. You spoke about this during Namaste, that like his worst fears have come true. Right, Sawyer told him, I guarantee nobody's going to ask who the president of the United States is. And he does just that, and Hurley just immediately says, all right, dude, we're from the future.
Yeah, so I just love that callback to Namaste. I think is a really funny closing of the loop. And just like, it's an example. I know it seems small. My favorite thing to do, take a small thing, make it a little bit bigger. And I know it's just like a throwaway joke. But I think that like it's emblematic of the writing style to season 5
mm-hmm.
of Absolutely. How much it just feels like it's very thoughtful. You know, like we're just like we set stuff up and we close it out. Like, I think that's one of the reasons why season 5 is so effective for me.
We've talked about how it's incredibly cohesive. In fact, we're talking about an episode where the next scene or the next couple scenes are going to be going back to a scene we saw in the premiere. But yeah, Dr. Chang, despite being so irascible in the previous 2 episodes, like, is actually, you know, starting to pick up what Daniel Faraday was putting down, right? He followed Hurley to be like, oh, okay, you actually are from the future. And I think part of this comes from, obviously, the very first scene we saw, and that we saw again in The Variable, of him unlocking into the orchid, talking about time travel. I think this is the concept that is not completely foreign to him. Well, I do agree with Sawyer in the previous scene that I think if they talk to these security doofs about where and when they're from, they're not going to be on board with it. But someone like Dr. Chang is totally ready to drink the Kool-Aid in that regard. And I will say that, you know, talking about closing of the loop, Miles finally gets to, like, talk with his father after his father has realized who he is.
Yes.
And his big moment, I think, will come later when they're watching through the bushes. But, like, if you watch this episode for anything character-wise, watch it for Miles.
It's very
this
sweet.
It's a little closing of this mini arc that we got over the past few episodes. And even through this episode, right? Because Miles wants to strike out on his own. He wants to start over. And he's like, screw Sawyer and Juliet, every man for himself. Very proto-Sawyer.
Yeah.
But now he's going to have a little bit of like his own Sawyer warming moment when he realizes that the dad he's been, you know, having such a bad opinion of all these years, it's not that bad of a guy.
Yeah. I just love that when Pierre looks at Miles, he goes, you're my son. He's like kind of like, it's like a happy moment, and like they don't like really dwell on it. They don't have like the huge hug or anything like that, but it is like this moment where Pierre Chang, it's like, I think it's like validation of his life's work, and then it's also like, you know, like pride in seeing his son in this moment being so intrinsically tied to his life's work, and then also like, all right, well, I got to work with my son to make sure that he lives and that everybody else here lives. Like, I have to get to work myself. And I feel like...
What I love about this episode is I think both Eloise and Pierre Chang very much have that attitude.
Yeah.
Like, they are both absolutely on board. They're like, great, here is the absolute most wackadoo thing I've heard in my life. Got it, digested it, ready to move on. Like, what's next? And I think that's a really fun way for these characters to get involved. Again, I know it's necessary given how propulsive the finale is, but good look on both of these characters to have these massive things appear, for both of them to be dealing with their own sons on the island in different ways, and for both of them to say, okay, clearly if that's the case, then this is something incredibly important that I need to do.
A really funny moment here is like Pierre Chang is like, all right, so your friend the physicist, like, he told me to evacuate everyone, should I do that? Pierre says, or it's Miles who says, look, if he said get off the island, I would do it. And then there's this whole moment of like, let's hope he knows what he's doing. And then we cut to dead Daniel Faraday on the ground, which is just absolutely incredible. Widmore is there and he's like, I swear this guy looks very familiar. I can't quite place it. Is he my son?
Yeah, back when I was a little bit more of like a whiny, short-haired a-hole, I remember someone who looked very similar to him.
Is this my son? And so Eloise is there. She's going to close Daniel's eyes. And like, it's interesting that like, she like, you know, she kills her son and immediately changes the course of her entire life. But she, instantly gets into action. You know what I mean? Like she copes with what she's done right away. Like she like becomes the Eloise Hawking that we know in this moment.
Yep.
I feel like
I would imagine that this is the transformative moment, right? Like I know we certainly saw some aggressiveness in Jughead and certainly aggressiveness to shoot Daniel Faraday in the back, no questions asked. But I do think this is a seminal moment in her life. I would imagine this is certainly what puts her on the path to be like, all right, I am the keeper of the sacred timeline in that way. But something that we should note here is that it seems like what's implied here, Josh, is not only did Eloise Hawking kill her son, but it seemed to imply she killed her son while she was pregnant with said son.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. Yes. So, hooray. Like, Faraday's still here. I don't know. Like, this is so messy. It's so messy.
It's incredibly messy. But you also wonder, like, how much does it have an impact on her character? I didn't mention it before, but I agree with what you've said back in Jughead, that War Turtle, middle stage Eloise Hawking, I think is really, really great. And I love the emotion she has on her face when she gets unfortunate confirmation from Jack about what, you know, who Faraday was and her experience. Like there is genuine emotion on her face. Like she is clearly very broken up about the idea of killing a future version of her son and the repercussions of her actions. And I feel like part of that has to be informed with who's in her belly right now. You know, there's one thing to be Pierre Chang and be like, here's my baby over here, and here's the future version of him. It's another thing for Eloise Hawking to be like, I am raising right now within my own body someone who I am going to kill. It's got to be such a torturous, tempestuous thought. And for Eloise Hawking in this moment to be able to plow through it and maybe use these remaining years to just sort of like push that trauma aside in order to serve a larger purpose sounds incredibly tragic.
Yeah, I totally agree. Richard's going to tell Jack that Charles and Eloise, love can be complicated, is what they say. And we use that to leverage ourselves back to the future, where Richard is walking with Locke and Ben. This is the sound clip we listened to before Bomb and the Radzinske, where the smoke monster is like telling them where to go. I'm the leader now. I want you to take me to Jacob. And Rich
right,
like,
it's that
okay.
thing where Ben's like, well, that's not how it works. He's like, yes, it does, Ben. Shut up.
Yes. Yeah. So, like, he's just very assertive in this way. He's not playing by the rule book. He's breaking down the foundations of how this is done. And so he's like, kind of like bulldozing his way towards a meeting with Jacob, and Richard being like, that's not how this goes by tradition. And like, say what you will about Benjamin Linus, but it would appear he observed tradition. This is the monster, and the monster knows that the tradition, at least in his opinion, is bullshit because he knows who's behind it. He's been there from the beginning. So he's just like, yeah, well, dangle that badge at me all you want. It's a piece of paper. I'm going to rip it up. You know, like, he's just like going to go through. So it's very scary. Like, the way that he just like steamrolls Richard, I think is rather frightening. But Richard, who is supposed to be this guy who holds the line, is just like also just not holding the line at all.
Right. And that's also a big setup for the final season, right? This idea. And we talked about this even with The Shape of Things to Come, of like, when the boss is defeated and there's a bigger boss behind it, you know, that adds a certain other layer of tension to it. We experience that when Kimi kills Alex, right? And Ben, who's the big bad of season 3, is defeated. And we certainly get it here. And I think it really sets up the destabilization that comes in season 6 of like, up to this point, Richard Alpert has been regarded as like the person in the highest position on the island. Benjamin Linus has been in the know the most out of any character so far. Here, someone comes in and basically like supplants them both.
Right.
And says, get down on your knees. Look at me. I'm the captain now.
Right.
I'm the new man in charge. We're doing this now. It's really frightening from that perspective to essentially have him come in under the guise of Locke saying, nope, we're doing things differently now. And he sort of proves his power here by closing this loop, right? Essentially proving like, don't worry, I know what I'm talking about, by taking them to John Locke and telling Richard everything he needs to know about the conversation they're about to have.
Mm-hmm. All right, so he's going to go and initiate this conversation. Let's listen into the rest of the scene here. Sound 4.
Richard. Richard. What is happening?
What's happening is you're bleeding to death. You need to get the bullet out.
How did you know there was a bullet in my leg, Richard?
Because you told me there was, John.
No, no. No, I didn't.
Well,
you will.
This must be quite the out-of-body experience.
Something like that.
Your timing was impeccable, John. How did you know when to be here?
The island told me. Didn't it ever tell you things?
No, John. And clearly it hasn't told you where Jacob is, or you wouldn't need Richard to show you.
You've never seen him.
What?
Jacob. You've never seen him, have you?
What just happened?
Where did you go?
To give Richard his compass back.
Want the bullet?
Keep it. Everything go all right?
Well, you seem pretty convinced. Especially when I said you were going to die. Certainly glad that didn't have to happen. Actually, Richard, it did. You better get back to camp.
I just love Michael Emerson's when.
Yeah. How did you know? Your timing is impeccable. How did you know when to be here? And he's playing with his food here. He's just watching from the sidelines, loving it, and also doing his other pivotal job here, which is to make Ben feel like a jackass. So that he's like even more riled up to go and kill Jacob in the next episode. The whole thing and like cutting back and forth. I mean, not for nothing, Mike, this is our last time seeing the living John Locke on the island.
That's a very good point. And he's being used as a chess piece in that regard, right? Yeah. He's being used as like a point of, hey, look, to show you how much I know this island, you have to do this. And it's less so like a final moment with John Locke and more so a dual, hey, here's how the man John Loki was able to use this version of John Locke to his advantage. But yeah, I absolutely agree. It is total like older sibling, younger sibling thing for John Loki to be like, yes, you know, the island told me where to go. Oh, did it never do that to you, Ben? Huh. I could have sworn after all these years that the island certainly would have told you where to be in certain portions of time. Oh, well, I wouldn't look into it if I were you. Certainly nothing to write home about.
Yeah, yeah. It's all great. It's really great. I love the like, you seemed pretty convinced, especially that part about dying. I'm glad that we didn't have to do that. And he's like, well, about that.
And Ben awkwardly looks down like, whistle, whistle, whistle. Hopefully no one addresses the elephant in the room again.
Beep, bop, boop. So it's just great. I don't know how much more we need to talk about the loophole. I think I've made my thoughts on it pretty clear. We're going to get to feedback at the end of the season. So if you've got thoughts on the loophole with the compass and everything, when we get to our season 5 wrap-up show, that'll be the place to revisit this in greater detail. In 1977, we've got Pierre he's like coming down to warn about the evacuation, but Radzinske is insisting that we gotta be drilling. We're on a schedule.
And you hear a voice in the back like, yeah, we gotta keep drilling.
Never stop drilling. I'm on it, boss. The boss. And Sawyer is gonna say like, all right, it's not safe here. This isn't good. This is the day. It's happening. Put us on the sub. We need to get out of here. Get the women and children out of here as well. And if you put me and Juliet on the submarine with you, we'll tell you everything you need to know. Are you cool with that, Juliet? She's like, absolutely. Yes, 100%.
So let's talk about this because, you know, this is a big pivot from Sawyer even an episode ago, where he was really trying to hold everything together, right? He was really trying to weave this tapestry that he's been constructing, much like Jacob, under the shadow of the statue for the past 3 years. And obviously he has lost control of that. You know, his own men are interrogating him. I think in this moment, Sawyer has to kind of like, not give up the ghost, but be like, all right, you know, the image of paradise is over. That's what Juliet kept telling him in the previous episode. And he's like, I got to keep going. He sort of embodies what Miles said earlier of, you know, screw the others that are back there. I think we're just going to have to leave. And I think it's something that he's not exactly happy about. But I think in this moment, it's all about survival. And I think he knows, especially if there is something coming, and especially since is not team blow up the bomb, that he's like, if we get out of here, that'll be nice.
Yeah. So he's happy with that arrangement. Meanwhile, Eloise and the others are with Jack. And Kate's not going to do this. She refuses. And we get like this real like tense situation where the others look like they are going to strike back. And it's a very lucky thing that Saeed has been lurking nearby in the woods where he is able to, I was going to say de-escalate the situation, but he's kind of escalating it, no?
It's more so like changing from one escalator to another.
People are dying. It's Saeed is, you know, he's back.
It's exchanging one body for another. Mm-hmm. Instead of Kate, it's Eric or the red shirt that they brought along, whatever his name was.
Right. So we got some people getting shot. Albert is like really out on all of this. And Eloise is like, listen, we got to do this. If they're right about what they need to do, it has to happen. It has to go down. Now that Saeed has rejoined the party, he's going to have some more thoughts on everything that's going down, especially when he realizes what he believed his purpose to be has been completely negated. And he's not going to be thrilled about it. And Kate is going to kind of read him the riot act. Let's listen in sound number 5.
So you're telling me you're going to erase the last 3 years of our lives?
We can change things, Saeed.
I don't know if you're aware of this, but I've already changed things. I killed Benjamin Linus. And we're all still here.
It's because you didn't kill him. Sawyer and me took him to the others so that they could save him.
Why did you do that?
Why did I do that? Since when did shooting kids and blowing up hydrogen bombs become okay?
The three of us disappeared off that plane and ended up here, ended up now, because this is our chance to change things.
And if you're wrong, then everyone on the island dies. Do you understand that?
I'm not wrong, Kate. This is it. This is why we're here. This is our destiny.
Do you know who you sound like? Because he was crazy too, Jack. You said so yourself.
Well, maybe I was wrong.
No, you were right. I'm going back to find the rest of our people, because if I can't stop you, then maybe they can.
It's interesting if you think about the beginning of the episode where Daniel Faraday walks in and gets shot, and Jack and Kate are getting, you know, farcist over in a tent. Probably in a tent nearby, Josh, is baby Ben Linus recovering from his trip to the temple.
Yeah. It's a good thing Saeed doesn't know that, because then he just leaves and, like, slips in and smothers baby Ben.
And then they're like, oh, gotta take him back to the temple again. And they just keep bringing him back again and again and again.
Just making him worse and worse and worse. I think that this whole scene is really, really great. I love Kate, like, calling it like it is. Like, you sound like Locke. He was crazy, too. And Jack's like, no, I think he was right. And Kate's like, no, you were right. This is wrong. And I think what's great about it is, like, he's saying this is our destiny. And so, like, in ways, they're both right. They are destined to do this. This has to happen because, you know, the fundamental underpinnings of how time works in this, that if they don't do this, then the Swan Station never exists. And obviously the Swan Station is very important to their lives and a thing that they've used and moved around in the past. So, like, he's right in that it's their destiny, and Kate is right in that he's wrong for wanting to do this, and that the things that they are doing are wrong. He's not wrong in that, like, this is destiny. He's right about that, but what he's trying to do is fundamentally wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the thing about Kate is that, you know, especially when you get into what Kate did.
It is kind of funny, which is, like, blowing up bombs is wrong. And it's like,
blowing up a house, though. Yeah, don't worry about that.
Yeah, that's fine.
But that's to that point, though. I think she very much has her own sort of moral compass in its own time loop of, like, a means to an end from a certain perspective, right? Like, she goes after Wayne because of the really depraved stuff that he put her and her mother through. And she saw that as the only way out. The reason why Kate is constantly running is because she feels like there is always a way out of a situation. And so I do think that she has experienced as well, like, people suffering because of the actions she has done, like Tom, for example. So I think when she talks about, like, what are you two doing? You're shooting kids, you're blowing up hydrogen bombs. She's very much coming from this perspective of, look, I've done some stuff back in my day. I'm not proud of it, but I do it for, you know, I have at least a relative sense of what not to do. It seems like with you two, it's no holds barred, and that's not the way to proceed, in my opinion.
Yeah. So I just love the whole exchange. I think it's a fun philosophical argument, and I think it's a great example of how, like, someone can be both right and wrong at the same time, I think is very much...
And it all depends on your own perspective and sort of, like, the values that you take. And especially the post He's Our You, Saeed, is also a really interesting character as well. We're going to get into it in another very fun line later on, but, like, Saeed is just, like, very much, like, whatever happens, happens. And then, you know, for lack of a better term, right? Of, like, I'm a killer. I'm a bad, bad man. So sure, let me blow up an entire orphanage. It's fine. I already have a terrible, terrible personality.
Yeah, it's already okay.
I am a killer. I try to kill a kid.
Yeah. The Dharma Initiative are putting people on the submarine. Young Charlotte gets on the sub. Pierre puts young Miles and his wife on the sub. And Miles watches from a distance. He's like, oh my God. He's doing the what is it?
The Harry and the Hendersons, where they throw rocks at Harry so he goes into the woods.
Go, yeah.
Ken Lang does a really great job of delivering his line because this feels like an epiphany to him. And again, I think it's really closing this arc where, in Some Like It Hot, one of the reasons why he didn't want to talk to Chang is A, because it's awkward. B, he doesn't want to reopen that part of his life. And C, because his mom told him his entire life that his dad was a jackass who wanted nothing to do with him.
Yeah.
And now his entire worldview has changed of like, no, he was actually really caring and only did what he needed to do. Made sure this was the last time he ever saw the son that he loved so much until right now because he wanted to save their lives. And I think it's a genuinely touching moment. It's an incredibly small moment for an incredibly small arc. But it's a moment I really appreciate.
I love it. I think it's really, really beautiful. They see Sawyer and Juliet going to the sub. They're like, all right, cool. They've got a plan, I'm sure. And indeed, Sawyer does have a plan, but his plan is basically the Biff Tannen plan.
We're going to find me. Instead of us, I'm my own sports almanac, Blondie.
I don't need an almanac. Yeah, so it's like, we're going to bet on the Cowboys in the 78 Super Bowl. We're going to be rich. It's going to be great. She's like, okay, yeah. Sounds good.
And there's some really sweet stuff here, though, right? Where Sawyer apologizes to Juliet, basically being like, hey, you know what? In LaFleur, we probably should have left on that day. But Juliet says she's happy she talked her way out of it. It's actually very evocative of that Jack-Kate scene, right? Where Sawyer's taking the perspective, much like Jack, of, yeah, none of this should have happened. You know, look where we are right now. And Juliet and Kate are coming from this perspective of, it wasn't all bad. In fact, right. It was a lot of good before the past couple days. And I really like this very sweet music as the two see each other. But then a really interesting moment where Sawyer stands on the sub, looks back on the island and says, good riddance. It's a really unique moment because remember, Sawyer didn't have that moment in season 4. He jumped out of the chopper. He sacrificed himself so that others could leave the island without him. I would imagine there's a lot of weird mixed emotions when it comes to leaving the island. But I think the derision and finality with which he regards leaving the island right now, I think is an interesting sort of like picking up where Sawyer was at the end of season 4, despite all the places he's gone in season 5.
I'm of a couple of minds here. I think it is terrific advancement of Sawyer's story that in this moment, he is content to leave the island where he has had a pretty good life the last 3 years. Because, as they say, home is where the heart is, and his heart is with Juliet. And so wherever they go, they will be at home. And that is enough. Dayenu. What doesn't jive with me quite as well is, like, so things are about to get really, really bad. Like, something is going to, like, potentially, like, something catastrophic is coming. Pierre Chang is saying it's not safe. Sawyer agrees it's not safe. And then he and Juliet are just going to leave. But what about Miles and Jin and Hurley and Jack and Kate?
Right.
Is Sawyer just like, c'est la vie, good riddance. I jumped out of a helicopter once for you guys. I'm not jumping out of a submarine. Is that
It feels so antithetical, though, to There's No Place Like Home Part 1, right? Where Sawyer's like, oh, God, Hugo's with them? Okay, we have to go to the orphanage.
Not only that, but, like, also, like, just, like, where he is now. That, like, he's done everything to, like, hold out until these guys come back, and now they're back, and he's not doing anything. I don't know. I don't know that I love this from Sawyer, unless someone's got, like, a really good, compelling argument as to why this is totally fine.
My response would be that it's not totally fine, but it might feel within character of where Sawyer is right now. Where, again, he's a con man. He built up this con for 3 years. It fell apart.
Right.
And I wonder if part of that is a bit of like, much like that old part of Jack is leaking out with the, oh, you can fix everything. It's part of old Sawyer leaking out of, all right, we just pack on up and move on to the next place. That despite the advancement that he's gone through, is there still a part of James Ford that is like, when the going gets tough, you can always just up and go to the next location and continue on. I wonder if that's a part of his personality that, granted, is not a good part of him, but something that he might be defaulting to in the face of just everything blowing up in his face sans a hydrogen bomb.
Yeah, I think that tracks to a certain degree. I don't have to love it.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's go from all of this. Let's go to the bomb. Richard is going to. This is the whole like swimming sequence, right? Like this is the.
Yeah. So this is like there's a lake that they're next to, and basically Eloise is like, well, you have to swim underneath the lake, which this is what Kate noped out of before, right? She's like, I'm not doing this. Jack understandably turns to Saeed and is just like, thanks for you know, shooting that guy before. You don't need to come if you don't want to. I totally understand this is a cockamamie proposition, but I'm going to be swimming forward. And so Richard and Jack are going to swim forward to this beautiful piece of set decoration. We continue on the temple theming here as we get to explore the tunnels. Some nice Richard sass here, too, right? Where Jack's like, how are we going to get the bomb out? And Richard's like, well, obviously, we're not going to take the bomb underwater, doctor. We have other ways. Don't worry.
Yeah. Saeed has an incredible line here. It's so great that I wanted to have it on here as a sound if you want to give it a rip.
Didn't think you'd come.
Well, if this works, you might just save us all. And if it doesn't, at least you'll put us out of our misery.
I see this as an absolute win.
Yeah, I love that. I think that that's such a great line from Saeed and like very in line with the character. You know, mm-hmm. He's just kind of very pragmatic. It's like, all right, either this works or we're instantly incinerated and well, game over.
You know? And then this is also, again, from this character, right? Who, again, not to say he's suicidal, but he's very much like, I'm a bad person. I've done a lot of bad things. I'm a killer through and through. If I died here, it's totally cool. Well, it's absolutely fine. And we'll, you know, save that for next episode, right, when he actually is on death's door.
Well, also, though, like, he still believes that, in, like, what he did, right? Like, he tried to kill Ben, and by killing Ben, maybe undo all of the misery that happened to everybody else. And then, like, they saved Ben's life, so his plan didn't work. But he may still believe that, like, we can change everything by eliminating a component of the past. Like, don't you dare tell me that I don't have free will here. Don't you dare tell me that I can't, like, actually change something.
Don't tell me what I can and can't do.
He hasn't had the whatever happened conversation with anybody. He hasn't had a moment to, like, observe that science with Daniel Faraday or anything like that. So Saeed, who is a guy who believes in what he sees and believes in himself and his abilities, certainly believes that he could kill a kid if he has to, if it means changing the future. And if he was already willing to do that, then blowing up a nuclear bomb is, you know, not a huge leap. But it is interesting to get Saeed back in this territory, right? Having wasn't that like a big piece of what he was doing in The Greater Good? He was like on this mission to infiltrate a sleeper cell and potentially blow up a huge bomb. So now he's back in that territory, and this time he's not standing down. This time he's all the way in.
Right, and I think that's also a point of how maybe he learned from that experience too, right? Because that was also, he had to like, he didn't like fall for the mark, but if I recall that episode correctly, this was an old friend of his, and he felt mm-hmm. guilty about what he was doing to the point where Omar finds out. I forgot whatever his name was, and he kills himself. So, like, perhaps Saeed learned from that experience of, like, no, 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 you don't become the person to stop this operation. You become part of the operation at the end of the day. And so, yeah, it looks like Team Bomb at the moment is Richard Alpert, Eloise Hawking, Jack Shepard, and Saeed Jarrah, which is a good get just in general to have Saeed on your team. Because he's a very good executor of plans.
Very strong squad. All right, let's get into the penultimate sound of the episode. It's going to be Fake Lock, Ben and Richard returning to the group, and Smokey McSmokerton has a few things he'd like to say to the crowd.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Locke. I've been told that for some time you all have been accepting orders from a man named Jacob. And yet, oddly enough, it seems that no one has actually seen him. Now, I'm sure there are very good reasons why his existence and whereabouts are a secret. I just don't know what they are. And to be honest with all of you, if there's a man telling us what to do, I want to know who he is.
This man, Jacob, can he tell us how to bring Jin and the rest of our people back here?
Absolutely.
Richard has agreed to show us where we need to go. So I'm going to go and see Jacob. Right now. And I'd like all of you to come with me.
I'm starting to think John Locke is going to be trouble. Why do you think I tried to kill him?
Trouble, my friends, with the capital T and that rhymes with P for putting a knife in Jacob.
Yeah, with a capital Y and that rhymes with I and that stands for island. Yeah, so they are going to, they're going to go on a little expedition. And this is very troubling for Richard. He's like, oh man, I've been waiting all this time for this guy? This is the guy?
Yeah, and I didn't play it before, but the scene prior to this with the dialogue is just complete steamrolling, right? Like, Locke keeps interrupting Richard. He just says, hey, is everybody here? He's like, no, not really. That close enough. All right, everybody, gather around. Take a knee. Time for a huddle here. And yeah, this is it's a big speech from Locke. It shows, again, it's a little scary because it shows that it's not really shown in this moment, more so in season 6, but like the whole idea of Man in Black, acolytes and who he infects. That's an idea that sort of gets set up here of the influence he's able to wield over people is significant. And yeah, in this moment, he's able to convince an entire group of people of like, yeah, let's go see Jacob. Why haven't we ever seen him before?
I had a thought just now. Cause Sun's like, can this guy, Jacob, tell us how to bring Jin back? And Locke's like, yeah, absolutely. Does the smoke monster think that everybody in the Dharma days, does he view it the same way Richard Alpert views it? And does he think they all die there? Does he think that they all get nuked? And therefore, if he kills Jacob, if he has Ben kill Jacob, and if it's Jin, not Sun, who's the Kwan on the wall, are the candidates dead? And is it checkmate? Does the smoke monster think it's about to be checkmate here?
Oh, that's a really interesting idea.
And
because,
so
yeah,
season 6, he's like kind of scrambling. He's like, shit.
No, he's acting super cocky, right? Like, he has the ball at the 1 yard line and is about to like spike it in the end zone of like, hey, I have everything. Just got to get Ben to stab Jacob. It's an interesting idea.
It's like,
I mean,
bro, we've got 18 episodes after that. He's like, shit, I didn't realize we got another season. Damn it.
Well, even after all that, though, I think it would make sense that he knows what Richard and assumingly Jacob do, right? Of, oh, yeah, this bomb blew up and all these people died. Yeah, we're experiencing them now, but eventually they're going to travel back in time to the 70s and all die via an explosion. That, yeah, now that I think about it, now there are certainly, I think, candidates that still exist out there, right? Like, Ben, I think, was a candidate, so like he still is hanging around, but yeah, it could be a way for him to be like, well, once we kill Jacob, there's a lot of candidates gone at this place, so he continues to sell Sun a load of BS just to be like, yeah, sure, he'll give you a heart, Tin Man, and he'll give you some courage, Lion, and Sun, he'll give you your husband back, don't you worry.
Right, but Jacob knows that they're coming. He's going to say that to them. They're coming, you know? So how he knows that, why he knows that, is it just belief or does he know it? And does he know something? Cause you're going to see it on the Man in Black's face when he leans down. He's like, I can't hear you. And he says, they're coming. And he does not look happy about it. It looks like shit. There's another level. I thought this was the final boss.
I don't have any more quarters for this.
Yeah.
That last exchange of lines in this scene, I'm starting to think John Locke is going to be trouble. Why do you think I tried to kill him? It's a fun cut to black, but also, like, that's not the reason why Ben tried to kill him, though. right? The reason wasn't, oh, John Locke's going to be trouble when he comes back. Well, we've talked about this.
Yeah, but I think to him, it's like he's a little more trouble than he's worth, you know, maybe a piece of it. Like, that is what he's going to tell him at one point. He's like, yeah, I tried to kill you because I just didn't have time to convince you to hang yourself again, you know? So it's like, I think that there is a piece where, like, yeah, I've been dealing with him and he's just a pain in the butt. You know,
like, yeah, I don't like but, it. Though I think the way he's coming across here, though, at least the delivery to me was more of like, he was a big threat. That's why I had to take him out. Which, again, like, we talked about this in Dead is Dead. We talked about this in Jeremy Bentham. That's not exactly the reason why. Though, to your point, it might have been a kernel of it.
Yeah. Remember when they called him the Colonel? All right, back on the submarine. We're not going to Ann Arbor. Once we hit the dock, we're free. We'll go into the real world. Juliet's like, what is that? And he's like, it's a show on MTV. We'll pitch it. We'll make money.
I'm going to be the first person on it. They're going to cast me as the stereotypical redneck. Yes. Put me in there with the gay guys.
It's
going to
be great. It's going to be great. He says, whatever happens, I got your back. They exchange I love yous. It's very, very, very sweet. And then, of course.
Yeah. Again, especially considering we know what's coming down the line. And also, like, if you're talking about sliding doors, obviously this wouldn't happen, but, like, they nearly left. They nearly went off into that paradise, you know, that they were talking about. But hold on, we got one more!
Oh,
and
my
Kate
God.
Comes down.
Yeah, with Mitchell
Love
Security.
The Love Quadrangle is back on the menu, boys.
Yeah, here's Paul the gunman, right? He's going to be on the submarine as well. Well, it's not fair that my cousin Saul gets to go underground and just drill everything. I get to at least go underwater. Otherwise, it's not fair. Fair is fair.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I would say that in another universe, Paul overhears Sawyer and Juliet, makes it off the island, bids on Microsoft, and becomes like a big tycoon.
Yeah.
You know, becomes one of the richest men in the world because of what he overheard.
So Kate is now with the sub crew, and it's like, oh, geez, here we go. The submarine departs, goes underwater, and holy effing crap. The absolutely atrocious graphics.
Yes!
Of
yes!
this submarine.
Yes!
This submarine yes! is dog shit. It's
this
so
submarine
bad.
Is terrible. It makes the plane crash in Namaste look like Gollum from Lord of the Rings.
It's atrocious.
Comparison.
It's atrocious. It's blocky. It's pixely. It's so bad.
The effect of the water around it is terrible. It looks like they lifted an effect from like Lost Via Domus, that video game that we spoke about, and just put it in the middle because they were running out of time.
Don't include the shot. There's got to be another way to convince us that you've submerged. This is so bad. The CGI submarine has always really, really, really bothered me. It has never improved. It is so bad. It's garbage. It's terrible. I'm giving it a preemptive LVP point.
Oh, yes. It's just bad.
It's like,
Galaga, game over.
It's one of those inanimate objects that is so atrocious that it absolutely deserves an LVP point. The CGI submarine is going to take a hit here. It's just so bad. I hate it. I laugh every time.
It takes you so much out of the scene because, again, there's tension. It's like, well, what's going to happen now that Kate's here? And then, like, oh, no, everyone, welcome to the, you know, the SS 1997 in computer graphics right next to the original Toy Story heading into the water. Very believable.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Not great. Back in 2007 with Saeed and Jack, or sorry, back in the 70s with Saeed and Jack and Eloise and Richard. There's going to be like a little bit of this moment of like 30 years from now, Eloise is going to tell me how to get back to the island. So I trust her enough that she doesn't just want to kill Dharma, that like she's in this for the right reasons. They reach the nuke. And now it's a little bit of like, okay, well, what do we do next? Well, we'll have to tune in next week to find out.
Well, can you give me like 7 days and then I'll tell you what to do?
Yeah. Well, just come back next week. We'll tell you everything. Let's close out the episode with the final sound. This is iconic stuff. No need for the setup. Let's listen in.
Beautiful day, isn't it?
Yes, so far. Richard had some concerns.
Concerns about what?
This pilgrimage to Jacob makes him uncomfortable. He's expressed reservations about whether or not you know what the hell you're doing.
I appreciate you bringing this to my attention, Ben.
I know we've had our differences in the past, John. But I'm here to follow you now.
So if you need Jacob to help you reunite your people, then I'll do whatever.
I'm not interested in being reunited with my people.
What do you mean? You told Sun.
I know what I told her, but that's not why we're going to Jacob.
Then why are we going to Jacob?
So I can kill him.
Is such a rat.
I love it. I love everything about
well,
this.
Well, Richard was having problems. Only Richard, not me, though. I'm totally with you.
Yeah, he's such a nerd. What a little loser, this guy. And I just love Smokey being like, yeah, no, I'm lying to everybody. I'm going to kill him. And you're going to just like sit with that information because I've already scared the bejesus out of you. And I know that you're in line. So like, I just need to tell somebody what I'm about to do because it's too good. I can't sit on this alone anymore. Obviously because he needs him to do the thing, but like, I just love like sort of the giddiness of like, oh yeah, no, I'm not interested in any, I kind of just want to go to Jacob so that we can kill him.
No, it's a good point that, like, obviously he needs Ben to be the one to do it. So, like, clearly this is another step in the con to be like, I'm going to do it. Because that's, again, speaking onto that really jealous younger sibling dynamic that he's been trying to plant the seed of, right? Of, oh, I get to do this and you don't. And so Ben's like, no, I want to be the one to kill Jacob. It's my thing to do this time. It's a brilliant move by Smokey. Such a thud from this final line. Ben is awestruck. This is a character who we talked about is often not surprised to the point where he is like stark standing still, completely aghast at the idea. And it's a huge revelation as well, right? We have yet to meet Jacob proper. That's going to be the big focus next week. But still, the idea of essentially him ending the episode by saying, I'm going to go kill God, is a huge revelation, especially if you think this is John Locke, that he has a purpose now. And you think like, oh, his purpose is to be in service to the island. He's going to be the ultimate devotee to it. No, he's going to kill the guy on top of the food chain. That is a giant way to end the episode. And I think a really, really exciting setup on both sides, right? We have this bomb that is going to be set off and just the tension of, well, apparently it does go off, but and do they all die from it or do they succeed here? And the show changes completely. But also, John Locke is going to kill God. How is all of that going to work?
Yeah. I love it. I love it. I think it's a really great ending. I think it's really powerful when you know who this guy is. It's very scary. And it's just such a good setup for the incident, which is where we are going to go next week. Before we close out, we got to do some rankings. We got to do the stars again. We're going to do feedback at the end of the season, so we will hold off on that. But let's rate the episode. I'm giving this one a 3.7. Like, I think like this episode feels it's got like a same quality level as some of those like earlier season 5 episodes for me. Mm-hmm, I think that like it is chess PC, but I think that like that stuff is fun for me. The character interactions are great. An episode that has like a meaningful amount of time between Terry O'Quinn and Michael Emerson is always going to be really fun for me. Throw Nestor Carbonell in there as Richard Alpert, and I think you've got a real good cosmic gumbo. I love the stuff in the past. I love where Jack is at. I think it's really interesting to pick apart. I think that the Hurley scene is the Hurley, you know, the joke there of all right, fine, we're from the future. It's just such a fun payoff, and I love how they handle Miles and Pierre. I really enjoy watching this one. It's not a next level episode of Lost, but I do think it's a great episode of Lost. In so far as episodes of Lost are basically all great.
I might go so far as to say this one is underrated, in my opinion. I went with a 3.6, which is about where I put, like, The Lie and This Place's Death. Both of those, I feel like, are more flawed episodes with higher highs, whereas I think this is a really solid episode of Lost. I think maybe it gets a bit more forgotten because, like we've talked about before, it's much more plot-forward of, let's get Kate and Sawyer and Juliet on the sub. Let's get Jack and Saeed with the bomb. Let's set off to go kill Jacob. But there's so much other character stuff baked into that. Like we said before, the Miles arc sort of gets complete here. We hear a lot about Jack and Kate's separate perspectives as to why they're going in their own individual directions. Saeed gets his perspective. We find out a lot more about, you know, John Loki claiming his power here. He came to that a bit in Dead is Dead, but I think now that that sort of like judging is out of the way from the smoke monster's perspective, this is really him high on his own supply. I think it's actually a pretty strong episode character-wise that I did not remember so usually or in retrospect. So yeah, it's a 3.6 from me. It averages out to a 3.7 for the audience. I'm seeing as low as a 3, as high as a 4.1 from the great Zach Brooks. So generally, some pretty, you know, consistent thoughts about this episode. That's going to average out to a 3.65, which edges out the aforementioned This Place is Death and The Little Prince as the number 10 episode of the season. Gotta feel, Josh, that's going to be number 11 by the time the season is done.
Oh, yeah. Incident is coming in. We should say a bit of a sea change as it stands. The variable is above LaFleur right now.
Right. After our whinging last week of like, why didn't anyone give it a 4.2? We did get several after our podcast. So yeah. Thank you for satisfying that.
Sorry for the thumb on the scale. The variable is just a smidge ahead of LaFleur. So if you're a huge LaFleur stan, now is your chance.
Ooh, this is the battle right now.
Yeah, but is the incident going to be above either of those? I'm interested to find out. I am.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a finale.
It's at least top three. I think so.
I think it's going to be a pretty clear 4.2 from me. So like it'll at least have that going for it. But I will be interested because I think that the incident being among the lower tiered finales, I think, is a conversation to have. And I think, you know, like all of the finales are basically of like an exceptional level. Is this among the weaker finales? Is it the weakest finale? You know, feel like every 16 to 23 episodes we have this kind of conversation. So I think it'll be a fun one next week. A supersized episode coming your way. We will have the feedback for you at the end of the season so that we can focus on the business at hand. One last piece of business at hand. It's the MVP LVPs. Mike, you've got 3 MVPs to give out. I've got 2. You've got 2 LVPs to give out. I've got 3. And one of those LVP points, as I've mentioned, is going to the CGI submarine. So one mystery has been established. Let's do the MVPs. Mike, where do you want to start?
I mean, we got to start with John Loki, right? We got to start with this.
You're giving
monster.
Him one,
this,
right?
I'm going to give him one because I'm going to divvy it out. But I think like this is a big in. This is a big episode for him.
Yeah.
And in a really big stretch of a season where he's able to really one up Ben and Richard Alpert, both of whom have been sort of like the big dogs. He's a bigger dog in that regard, able to sort of prove his worth, prove his knowledge, and move everyone forward in the success of his plan to kill Jacob. It really is like an all-time episode for the character.
Correct. He gets both points from my end. I am very clear about how much I love this character, especially the season 5 version of the smoke monster when you're in on the joke. I just think he's exceptional. I think it's Terry O'Quinn just having a blast. I think that the performance just totally translates. It's terrific stuff. It's a very clear 1-2 shot for me from my MVP points.
And we should mention that puts Smokey up to 9 points, tying Sawyer for MVP of season 5 so far. And Josh, again, let's not put thumb on the scale. I think we're looking at the new MVP of season 5. I think he's going to at least edge out Sawyer here in the finale.
I think it's possible. I think it's certainly possible. We'll see where it goes.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think he certainly does much more in the finale than Sawyer does. I'll say that.
Yes, yes, yes. All right.
And so
what else
I have 2 other points. Yeah, I alluded to this beforehand. I am going to give 1 point to Eloise Hawking and 1 point to Pierre Chang, just because I think both of them had pretty big bounce backs from their previous episodes, the previous faux pas they've committed. Both of them are totally on board with Team Time Travel. They are essential to what happens. Pierre Chang saves. I mean, if I had another MVP point, I might give it to another one to Pierre Chang because he saves so many lives in what he does here. Despite the fact that you have people being like, don't worry about it. It's fine. You don't need to evacuate the island. The fact that he does so, he saves Charlotte's life, saves his own son's life. Like, Pierre Chang does something really, really great here. And also partly because we talked about this last week with Saul the Drillman, I don't think we've ever given an MVP or LVP point to Peter Cheng before.
Wow, really?
And so we have to make sure he gets memorialized here. And this might be the last time because, again, it's a big episode, the incident. I don't know if Pierre Cheng is going to make it, so I wanted to acknowledge him here while he's doing something super good for the island.
He's in the sideways. We have some shots there, but I also think that it could be very crowded when we get to some of those opportunities. So I love it. I think it's great here. LVPs, as I've said, CGI submarine is just so bad. Mm-hmm. I
have two. Yeah. I'm giving them both to Radzinski.
Yeah, I'll pile one on, too, because he's terrible. Radzinski.
Yeah, I'm firm. For me, it's one for being just overly aggro and overstepping Horace, and the other one for being so stubborn. When Pierre Cheng, like one of the head honchos, walks in and says, "Don't dig," for you to say, "No, we're gonna dig," is just like so impudent, so buffoonish. So big mark on Radzinski this week.
I think that's fair. I'm going to give the last LVP point. I'll give it to Phil. I hate that guy. I really do. I really hate Phil.
He deserves it for hitting Juliet. Like we said before, I think last week, that he was like more of an ineffective weasel than like an outright villain. But this is when he started. After something happened in that closet, man. Now he's going to be an a-hole for these last two episodes.
It's not great. It's not great. Okay. Well, Radzinski really bringing it up in the LVPs. I think he's got that pretty close to locked. Negative 10 for Radzinski, and he's definitely going to accrue more next week. So I think he's going to be our season 5 LVP. And then I think the question is, will it be the Smoke Monster or Sawyer for our season 5 MVP is what it looks like to me. Juliet, unless she's going to like sweep, she's not really in a workable position, I don't think, with 6. And then John Locke has 8 MVP points, but he did. He's no longer eligible.
I know. This is the last time we could have given him a point in the real world.
Yeah. Is it Sawyer? Is it Smokey? Is it another tie?
Is it Frank Lapidus?
Yeah. Is it Frank? You know, we'll figure it out after the fact. Okay. So next week, it's the incident. It's happening. It's real. We're going to do the season 5 finale. The week after that is going to be the season 5 feedback special. You want to get your feedback in for that now, down the hatch at postshowrecaps.com. And because we are getting so close to it, let me just reiterate that what the schedule looks like for Down the Hatch is we are at the gates of season 6. We are at the door of the final season of Lost. We are watching Across the Sea as our first episode of season 6. So we're going with the incident, then the season 5 feedback special, and then Across the Sea. Do not go from the incident to LAX if you want to watch the final season of Lost in the official Down the Hatch order. You want to watch Across the Sea first. So bears repeating because we are very, very close to this thing that we have said we are going to do from the very start of Down the Hatch. So that is the news. That is what's coming up. You can get these podcasts early if you are a patron of Post Show Recaps by signing up at patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Down the Hatch comes your way 2 days early. You want to get that sweet Down the Hatch magic on a Wednesday instead of a Friday? Come on in. Water's warm. We'd love to have you. We're getting very close to the 1 year anniversary of the Post Show Recaps patron program. Lots of really fun stuff in the hopper for that. You want to get involved early? We know you do. Come on down. Patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Come talk with all your friends. We're going to be talking about Lost. You hear all these names all the time on the podcast. The great Jim Fells. Come say hi. Talk to all of these people. The Ben behind the curtain. He's here. Mike and I are there. Everybody's here. Joe Garfine's in the Discord. You want to be a part of this? Post Show Recaps on Discord, on Patreon, patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Consider signing up. Mike, anything else to add as we start to close this one out?
I'm excited for the incident. It's a big, big episode. This is going to be crack open a bottle of Pellegrino, Josh, because Jacob is finally on the scene.
Jokes that are designed to get me going. Wow. Yeah, just crack open that sparkling Mark Pellegrino. It's happening. We will imbibe.
Yeah, so it's a big thing because Jacob, again, often talked about not seeing. We thought we saw him for a second in the form of Christian Shepherd, but he's going to be playing a large role in the end game as well as season 6. Before he dies in this one. And it really is going to be a culmination of everything we've talked about. We've talked about it for so long. The fork in the outlet, I think, is the code they give for this final twist. we get Jacob being killed. John Locke is the man in black. We're going to talk about that reveal, whether it works at the end of the season. Ben's big move, if you will, to kill the man he has been worshiping for all these years. And then in the past, it happens. The incident. And Juliet dies. Sort of. It's heartbreaking. It's action-packed. It's going to be a big episode to talk about, much like many Lost finales are. And certainly game-changing. I know that we're going to take an extra week to get to it, but how the season ends, combined with how season 6 starts, gets the fans' minds a tizzy as to what exactly is going on and how wrong we were back then. So I am very excited to be talking about the incident and to really, I think, just start talking about season 6 of Lost, because between the touch of Jacob, the idea of the candidates, and the man in black truly taking the throne, it's a big, big shadow in the statue as to what's to come in the final season of Lost.
Yep. For sure. All right. What lies in the shadow of the statue? We will find out next week as we talk about the incident. Until then, everybody, take care. Bye-bye.
It's a beautiful morning. Let's take a nice long swim, dig into some newly found boar, and have a nice chat about the penultimate episode of Lost Season 5. Shall we, folks? Come on, let's do it.